Welcome to Inflammation Nation. My name is Gráinne O'Leary. Inflammation Nation is a podcast from Arthritis Ireland aimed at increasing awareness and understanding of arthritis and related conditions. Today, I am just delighted to be joined by Professor Kate Larrick. Kate has served as the director of the Stanford Patient Education Research Center and professor of medicine in the Stanford School of Medicine. She's a partner at the Self-Management Resource Center, and she is the world expert in the area of self-management for people living with long-term or chronic health conditions. And here in Arthritis Ireland, we have delivered Kate's program for many, many years to thousands of people living with arthritis and related conditions. So it's a particular pleasure to welcome you here, Kate. So thank you so much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here, and I just wish it could be in person because you at least have green grass and here we're very, very dry.
Well, thank you for that. And hopefully we do get to meet up at some stage. I've certainly enjoyed meeting you over the years that we've been developing and implementing the program here in Ireland. If I can start by taking you back to the start of your career, you started out as a registered nurse. You know, what led you to a career in patient education?
Well, when I was doing nursing, my interest was always in the field of public health. And the more I worked in public health, the more I realized that for many things, education was a key. I mean, there's certainly other keys such as cleaning water and epidemiology, things of that sort. But what really drew me was helping people to help themselves. And that's where I got drawn to education.
And I suppose, you know, as well as your background as a nurse, you also live with a chronic condition. So, you know, what impact has that combined with your medical background had on your role in developing what became the self-management program?
I was actually born with Gaucher's disease, which just means that I'm missing an enzyme and it has to be replaced every 2 weeks. It's a hereditary disease and none of you need to ever worry about it. But what it does mean is that I have literally lived with a chronic disease all my entire life and had to learn how to make accommodations to that disease. Fatigue is a major problem in my life, sometimes pain. And there were kind of no guides. You learned it on your own. And after I had learned some of the things that helped myself, I started looking at things that might help other people. And so I think that my personal experience had a great deal to do with my wanting to help other people learn to self-manage.
And I suppose in terms of, you know, when you look at the whole, I suppose, expansive range of chronic illnesses that are out there, you know, how do you think chronic illness affects people?
Well, we actually know pretty well how it affects people. It affects people in kind of three major ways. One is they need to do the medical management of their condition. And that means taking their pills, doing their exercises, that sort of thing. The second, which is probably the most difficult for people, is learning to do the things they want and need to do every day with chronic illness and kind of getting on with life. Because if you give up on the getting on with life part, life's pretty dull. And so figuring out how to do the things one wants and needs to do, in my case, since I have to get infusions every 2 weeks, it means that I can't go away from home for more than about 2 weeks, maybe three if I really push it. But that's an accommodation I know I have to make. And there's lots of accommodations lots of folks have to make. And then the third piece of living with a chronic illness means dealing with the difficult emotions that come with chronic illness. And that has to do with pain, with depression, with anxiety, with stress, because those things always come with chronic conditions. And by the way, those are the things that the medical professionals, for the most part, underestimate. And they underestimate it partly because those of us with chronic illnesses keep them hidden pretty well. But as we've done testing over the years, we've actually found that about a third of people with chronic illness, and it doesn't matter whether it's arthritis or heart disease, it really doesn't matter what the chronic illness is, but about a third of them are actually depressed and severely depressed, and enough so that some behavioral things probably will help that depression.
If I take you back to your first days, maybe back in Stanford University in the late 70s, the arthritis self-help course, as it was called then, was the first course you developed in what has become a huge suite of self-management programs. You know, why arthritis? Can you start to tell us a little bit about that journey from the late 70s?
In the 1970s, the United States Congress passed a bill called the National Arthritis Act. In that bill, they gave money for arthritis centers. Now, arthritis centers were not places that patients go, but rather they were centers at academic institutions that did a group of research projects around arthritis. Some of these research projects were bench research projects on the causes and cures for arthritis, but they also had to do educational research and they had to do epidemiological research or health services research. So Stanford was one of the first places in the country to get a National Arthritis Center, which meant they had to do some educational research. They didn't have any idea what that was. And so they went out hunting for somebody that would put together some sort of an educational program. I was a doctoral student at the time. I had zero interest in arthritis. I could barely spell it. And ultimately, I ended up going to Stanford and saying that, yes, I would put together a program for arthritis education, but they need to know I was only going to stay for 2 years because this wasn't what I was interested in. Yeah. And we are now 40 some odd years along the line. And I just got my reappointment letter for next year.
Wow. Many people listening will have maybe done the course. They'll have done the 6-week program that we've been delivering here in Ireland since 2006. But for the uninitiated, you know, can you tell us how the program works?
Sure. Let me tell you a little bit about how we designed the program, because then I think it'll help how it worked. We designed the program. When I first went to Stanford, I spent a month and a half wandering around to people's homes with arthritis and interviewing them about what their problems were and what their concerns were. And it was really, really very obvious that the number one concern was pain. The number two concern was basically being physically able to do the things they wanted to do, whether it was turn on a tap or walk or, you know, any of these other things that were joint pain gets in the way. And the third thing, which was very surprising to at least the people at that time, was depression and anxiety. And so knowing that, and I had the great advantage of not knowing what you were supposed to teach in arthritis courses. And so knowing that, I started looking at everything that we knew about pain management. And I was lucky enough to also work with some great physical therapists, some physios, who told me what we had to do about disability. And so we put kind of the best thinking about exercise, pain management, stress management, depression management. That was the content. And then we layered on top of that all the things that will help people actually begin to do things. Because everybody can read a book or can read the internet, and that doesn't mean we're going to do everything that we read. Getting started and actually doing things are what are important. And so in our courses, what we do is each week we have some content. People can talk to each other about their problems. We talk about some solutions to those problems. And then every week, people make an action plan. And an action plan is just a short self-promise. This week, I will walk for 20 minutes before breakfast on Monday, Wednesday, Friday. That's what an action plan looks like. And action plans can be anything anybody wants them to be. This week, I will take my dog to the vet on Wednesday. I've been meaning to do that. This week, I'm going to do that. So it's not, we don't tell people what their action plans should be. people make their own action plans. And then the next week when they come back, they tell us about how well they did with their action plan and if they had any problems with it, then the group and the facilitators of the program can help them look for solutions. So this whole idea of action planning and feedback is pretty key to the program. And then each week we work on two or three little bits of content. So it's not that we do 1 week of exercise and 1 week of pain management. Those sorts of things are spread throughout the entire workshop so that people can try things, build on it a little bit at a time. It's kind of like when you went to school, you didn't have 3 months of reading and 3 months of writing. You had a little bit every day.
And I suppose, you know, when you look at the program and how it's structured and the content there, you know, what is it about the program that actually empowers people to take control of their own health? Because that's a real linchpin of the program. Sure. As well.
I think what it is about the program is two things. They get to see people like themselves. They get to help people like themselves. And they also get to try things in little tiny bite sizes. So it's not, we're not running a marathon. What we're doing is we're doing little steps at a time. And little steps at a time ultimately may end up in a marathon, but I don't even worry about the marathon.
And I suppose, you know, one of the things when you look at the extent of the, I suppose, the content and the program and what you could have in the program. And I know this is something I've spoken to you about over the years, and I'm sure many people have said, you know, have written to you, emailed you, etc., about, you know, have you ever thought of including this in the program? But how did you approach the development of the program and, you know, reach that really all important decision about, well, what do I leave in the program? What do I not put in? You know, yeah. It's a difficult decision.
Yeah. Well, number one, we need to think about the fact that the program has been rewritten now, I don't know, half a dozen times or more. And each time that we rewrite, we use a bunch of different ways of looking at it. Number one, we ask both participants and leaders what things they would keep and what things they would get rid of and what things they would change. And we listen to them very, very carefully. Then the next thing is we go to the science. And how has the science changed around pain management, around exercise, around nutrition? I can tell you, for example, that when we started the program in the 70s, we knew nothing about cognitive behavioral therapy. And today, cognitive behavioral therapy, and don't worry about what that is, it's not seeing a psychiatrist. It's just some behavioral techniques. And now the program has a lot of those techniques built into them. We didn't know much about food and pain. And at least in our new pain program, which we're about to release, and the new pain book, we have a whole section on food and pain because we're beginning to understand a lot more about food and pain than we did before. There were lots and lots of beliefs. There were lots of books. I had no problem finding a book that said, if you follow this diet, your arthritis will get better.
Yeah.
But in fact, there was no scientific basis to it. And as I go back and look at those books now, because I made a collection of them, some of them were pretty good and some of them were pretty awful. And so we're beginning to understand that. So we always go to the science. So first we go to the people who have taken the course, and then we go to the science, and then we reshape the program. So as we reshape the programs, they look always pretty much the same, but some of the content is different.
You mentioned the pain program there, and obviously what started out as your research in 1979 with the arthritis self-help course. Can you give people listening just, you know, an idea of how that program or that seed, which was the arthritis program, has expanded now to the range of self-management programs that you have developed and also the availability of those programs worldwide?
Okay, well, we started with the arthritis program and probably 6 or 8 years in when we were doing it pretty widely in the United States, people started saying to me, you know, this stuff is really good, but my cardiologist tells me one thing, and my arthritis doctor tells me another thing, and my lung doctor tells me another thing, and my GP tells me another thing. I'm totally confused because I don't just have arthritis. I have arthritis and heart disease, or I have arthritis and hypertension, or I have arthritis and diabetes. And I'm just really confused. And that got myself and some colleagues thinking about maybe there's some things that are common across chronic illnesses. And so we spent a long time looking at all the literature about what's taught in chronic illness courses. So what's taught in hypertension courses, what's taught in diabetes courses. And what we found was that about 90% of the 80 to 90% of what was taught was really the same thing across all the workshops. And so given that, we put together a chronic disease self-management program. And that's for people with one or more chronic conditions, long-term conditions. It doesn't matter whether it's arthritis or heart disease or lung disease or whatever, or even bipolar or depression, because those are all chronic diseases too. And we put all these people together. People thought we were absolutely crazy. We had a lot of pushback. But in fact, what we found is it worked quite well. And then we tested the chronic disease program against the arthritis program and found out that people with arthritis who took the chronic disease program did just as well as people with arthritis who took the arthritis program. And so given that, we retired the arthritis program. And the arthritis program per se is no longer available. But then a few years after that, we started hearing from a lot of people with chronic pain. And the Canadians were the first to put together a chronic pain program based on the original arthritis program. And so today we have both the chronic disease program, and for those people where pain is really the overdriving condition, we have the chronic pain program. And then beyond those two programs, we have a diabetes program, an HIV program, a cancer program, and a caregiver program. Those programs are now used by about 1,500, 2,000 organizations all over the world, probably in about 30 countries. I will say that Arthritis Ireland was one of the very first places that any of these programs were ever given outside the United States. So we've had a very, very long association with Arthritis Ireland.
Yeah, and that's great to hear. And we continue the work here. We now deliver the chronic disease self-management program and continue to, you know, get just tremendous feedback from people who participate in that program. We're going to take a short break from our conversation with Kate to take our regular look at popular beliefs about arthritis. This week, Peter Boyd is exploring the disease of royalty, gout.
Thanks a million for that introduction, Gráinne. Today we're going to discuss gout, a form of arthritis that has developed some myths of its own over time. There are certain beliefs and understandings that have developed around arthritis as a whole. However, gout has a few all of its own too. A condition for men who consume vast amounts of red meat, red wine, rich food and stout, the image portrayed over the years has been of a Henry VIII character whose high living has caught up with them. This is not actually the case, and later we'll talk to consultant rheumatologist Professor Geraldine McCarthy to get the facts. But first, we asked our reporter Niamh Hogan to capture some current perspectives on gout from the people of Dublin.
Have you ever heard of gout or any words that you guys describe with gout? What would you think?
You eat too much rich food. That's food.
Too much alcohol.
And joint pain, I think you get.
Drink and food.
I wouldn't have a clue.
Any idea?
Like you can get gout in your feet.
Yeah.
Swollen feet and like bruises.
So do you think gout can only affect men?
No. Ladies as well, yeah. I think it affects everybody.
Both, I would say.
Yeah, it affects both.
I'd say more
well.
Men.
No, it affects everyone.
Yeah. Do you think that only obese people or overweight people can get
you
gout?
You see, that's the thing, people perception. Mm-hmm. No. No, definitely not.
Yeah, no.
No.
I would have thought so, but I presume everyone can get it then.
Yeah. Can you eat red meat or shellfish as a person with gout?
I have no idea.
So it's one of those rich foods that you
okay.
kind of have to...
It's probably too much of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can, but you're meant to go down on rich foods, I think.
it's one of the most common forms of arthritis in Ireland, gout is.
Gout is.
Yeah, one in four.
I absolutely wouldn't have known that.
Yeah,
gout is actually. I actually wouldn't have thought of that.
Totally. Would have thought it was more to do with when you think of arthritis, maybe in your hands or other parts, not your feet.
That's cool. Didn't know that.
So there we have it, the views of the people of Blanchardstown on gout. I'm very glad to be joined by Professor Geraldine McCarthy. And Professor, before we get any further, I suppose this perception of rich food, alcohol and gout and the link there pertains. Is that a problem?
Well, it's a huge problem for the simple reason that people tend to stigmatize gout because of this perception. In other words, they think they have gout, they're embarrassed about it, and they don't seek medical attention because they feel it reflects on their tendency to eat very rich food and drink too much, etc. And the fact of the matter is that gout itself is mostly a genetic disorder, and you'll frequently see people that are thin that have gout. The rich food and the too much alcohol and the obesity can exacerbate the situation. We've all heard of people having an alcohol binge and getting a flare of their gout, but it is not actually the cause of gout. And unfortunately, this message really needs to get out. Also, people think that if they just modify their diet, they can treat their gout. But studies have shown that strict diets, while they might be good for you, and certainly losing weight when required is good, it'll only lower your serum uric acid a small bit, not as much as is needed. Gout occurs because a person will have too much uric acid in their blood over a long period of time. And usually the reason they've too much uric acid in their blood is because their kidneys don't excrete it. Everybody has uric acid. It's just some people have too much. And in some of the people who have too much, the cartilage in their joints or something else, we don't know quite what, allows the gout to crystallize, to form gout crystals. And these are the entities that cause that severe attack of gout that people will recognize. So the only real way to treat it or to get rid of it or to prevent it happening is to take medication that will lower the uric acid to a target level in the blood. And yes, it's good to avoid being obese, and it's good to not drink excess alcohol, and it's good to have a healthy diet, but it is not the cause of gout per se.
And we look at that, and you mentioned, you know, maybe embarrassment of coming forward, and is a prevalence in men in particular. Would there be a link there as well of men not coming forward and sharing their symptoms as well?
Well, I think there's a kind of a stereotype of men being less inclined to present for medical advice when it's appropriate. So there's certainly that. Also, there have been papers published showing that the depiction of gout in the media as something that's a joke nearly is another thing that prevents men coming forward. And a lot of the men I see are very long-suffering. They just really put up with it. And they tell me it's the worst imaginable pain. So, and it tends to occur just when the time is wrong, like they're about to get on a plane or they're about to go to a meeting. So it can really interfere with people's lives. And I don't think people appreciate that it's actually essentially curable. So, you know, people do not need to suffer on. We're really trying to improve education about gout. And I think, you know, education is improving, certainly with the launch of new medications. Drug companies arrange a lot of education sessions for both medical people and also patients. And so inch by inch, things are improving. But I think it's really good to have a podcast like this to try and further educate, because we have a long way to go.
Well, that's it. We're all about dealing with the myths and beliefs that have built up over time on Inflammation Nation. And hopefully we can continue to get the message out there. Thanks very much, Professor McCarthy, for joining us. And it's back to the rest of the interview on Inflammation Nation.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter. Kate, have you faced any problems in implementing the programme over the years?
I think the biggest problem has been the programme, with some rare exceptions, is not well integrated into the healthcare system, which means that organizations do the program, they come and they go, and you know, no program is free, so there always has to be funding for these programs. And I think that has been the limiting factor in many cases. It's interesting to me that at least in the United States, we're beginning to see integration into many more healthcare systems. You know, we have this hodgepodge of mess of healthcare systems in this country. And we're beginning to see more integration of that into those systems. But I think that has been one of the larger drawbacks, because even after all these years, the program is not well understood by healthcare professionals and is always looked at as a little bit suspicious unless people actually seen it and looked at it. Now, in Ireland, you're lucky because you've been around for a long enough time that my guess is there's very little suspicion about the program anymore.
I think sometimes it can be viewed as sort of a nice to have as opposed to, you know,
a must have.
A must have. Obviously, in Arthritis Ireland, we would see it as a must have. How do you, you know, for again, for people listening and for maybe organizations listening as well, who are maybe thinking about embarking on, you know, the adoption of the program or are currently delivering the program, have you any advice on how to, you know, I suppose, deal with those kind of issues and that maybe that resistance to support it?
What I usually tell health professionals is that people with chronic illness live about 1% of their life in the doctor's office or in hospital, which means they have to spend the rest of their lives figuring out how to live on a day-to-day basis. And they do that with self-management. And docs say, well, you have to learn to live with it. Well, in fact, that's true. You do have to learn to live with it. Now, you can do it with trial and error and be more or less successful, but it's a whole lot more efficient if you let folks that have spent their entire lives trying to figure this thing out at least let you know what they've learned so that you can try it. That doesn't mean you don't still do trial and error, but it means you have a much bigger base to start out with. You know, when you go to the library and you're just kind of wandering around looking for a book, you pick up a book and you think, this looks interesting, but you get home and you find out it isn't. And that's trial and error. But if you know that a friend of yours and you have very similar tastes in reading and a friend says, I really like this book, there's much better chance that you're going to like it too. And so when I talk to health professionals, I say what we're trying to do is we're trying to teach people how to learn to live with it and to do it in such a way that it impacts their lives. And it also makes your life easier because they don't complain as much. They don't come in as much and they have more realistic ideas about what can and cannot that be done but with medicine. For example, if you have rheumatoid arthritis, we have made huge changes. From the day that I started in the field of arthritis to today, the medical treatments for rheumatoid arthritis are just amazingly different, and people's lives are very different because of it. Mm-hmm. Osteoarthritis, which is the most common type of arthritis, unfortunately, what we were teaching 40 years ago and what we knew medically 40 years ago has not advanced that much. We have some advances, and we're getting closer, but it hasn't changed that much. And so learning to live with it is what we're trying to do.
And that probably brings me nicely onto my next question is, you know, what have been the outcomes and the benefits of the program? And obviously there's been a huge body of research over many years.
Basically, people that take our programs, if they have pain, they have less pain. They have less depression and they're more active in life. And they tend to visit physicians fewer, less time. That's kind of a summary. And it's not every study in every country in every way, but it's a general summary of the outcomes of our studies. In diabetes, people that take our diabetes programs tend to have lower blood glucose and less symptoms of hypoglycemia and also less depression. So it kind of depends on the program. We just did a study of the pain program, and people, you know, 40 years on had pretty much the same outcomes as we had with the arthritis program to begin with. They had less pain, they had less depression, and they were more confident or more sure that they could take care of themselves on a day-to-day basis.
They're amazing results. And I think I always think of that aspect of if people can increase their confidence, you know, and that's obviously one of the underlying principles of the course as well. If you're confident, you're more likely to be able to, you know, I suppose, manage your health condition on a day-to-day basis. So it's interesting that is supported across all of the programs that you've developed over the years. So if I can bring you to the last 18 months, you know, we've been, obviously the whole world has faced this, you know, unprecedented situation with COVID-19. How has self-management for people living with long-term health conditions, how has that been impacted by the pandemic?
Oh, amazingly, amazingly. I live in a part of the country that was really on pretty much total lockdown for many, many, many months. And to some extent is still on partial lockdown. About a month into the pandemic, one of our sites in Detroit called me up and said, we were halfway through a program and we're going to continue on Zoom. They didn't even ask. And I said, okay, can I watch? I don't think this is a good idea, but let me watch. And I watched their three last sessions on Zoom, and it occurred to me, this could actually work. And so we very, very quickly pivoted to where we allowed all of our sites to offer programs by Zoom, or, and if it's not by Zoom, it could be by any other platform. I know in Europe, you don't use Zoom as much as you use Teams and some other platforms.
We're using Zoom a lot. We use it for all of our programs online at the moment. Yeah,
oh, you
we do.
Okay.
We do.
Okay. Okay. Some places keep telling me they can't do that, but that's okay. But whatever, it's a whatever platform, it doesn't matter. So all of our classes can be given by Zoom, and we have trained all our leaders and all our master trainers and, kind of rewritten our scripts a little bit so that they can be done by Zoom. We then had people say to us, yeah, but a lot of people don't have the internet or won't use the internet. How about the telephone? So we said, oh, okay. So we put together a course that could actually be delivered by telephone. It's delivered in very small groups in 3 to 5 people with only one leader. But again, it's 6 weeks and it's people on a call for about an hour a week. And the study I just told you about with the pain program was actually a pro study that was done with a telephone version of the pain program. So we have really moved the programs almost entirely virtually. I think there's very few places in the United States, if any, that are doing in-person programs, maybe a few, but very few right now. And almost all of them are virtual. And I think once we get finished with the pandemic, this is probably going to continue. I think we'll have in-person programs, but I think we're always going to have programs virtually as well. There's some real advantages to virtual programs. We can certainly get to rural people much easier. We can get to people that are severely disabled much easier. We just had a leader training the other day where we were training leaders on Zoom. And I realized that one of the people that we were training was in bed. And we talked to that person later, and it's because this person is extremely disabled. But they can lead a course, which they could have never done before. And so there's some real advantages. Of course, there's some disadvantages because it's really great to see people face to face and eat scones or whatever together. But, you know, I think the more options we have for people, the more people we can reach. So I've become a believer very, very quickly, screaming and dragging my feet all the way.
It's certainly been a really good option for us here in Ireland. We're a small country, but we still have parts of the country that would be quite remote. So the ability to deliver a virtual course during the pandemic has, again, I couldn't have seen it working, but it has. And there are some huge benefits to it. So it will be something we'd be seeking to continue with as well.
You can also do some very interesting things. We did a training the other day, and in that training, we had people from the United States, from Canada, from England, and from Tasmania and Australia, all in the same training.
So, Kate, just one final question for you. What does the future hold? You know, what are you and the Self-Management Resource Centre? What are you working on at the moment? Is there anything you'd like to share with us?
Well, we have just released our new chronic pain self-management book, and we'll release our new workshop at the very end of this year. And so I think that's the newest thing. I think the good news is I don't see us revising anything else for a couple of years. We just have to consolidate, and we've been running so fast that we just need to take a few breaths and look at what's happening. So I think that for right now, we're pretty up to date. But if any of you out there would like something, let us know. We always are looking for ideas. No, we probably will not do a course on facial pain, which is something that somebody asked me to do yesterday, because the audience is probably too small. We try to do courses for larger groups of people as opposed to smaller. And the facial pain people will do fine in the pain program. But having said that, we're always looking for ideas. And a lot of the best ideas in our workshops come from the participants themselves.
Well, Kate Lorick, thank you so much for joining me today.
You are very welcome. And I hope to do it in person next time.
That's all from this episode of Inflammation Nation. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. For further information about Arthritis Ireland, you can visit our website, arthritisireland.ie, or contact our helpline on 0818 252 846. See you next time. Inflammation Nation is supported by Pfizer.